Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. Once upon a time, chefs stayed out of sight in the kitchen and let their food speak for them. Now the kitchen's a TV studio, and chefs are mega celebrities we know by their first names, Emeril, Giada, and Rachel.
I'm making pork chops with brandied cherry sauce. Sounds fancy, doesn't it?
This hour, On Point, making sense of America's celebrity chef culture. Later in the hour, we'll be joined by Alton Brown from the Food Network. But first, from Washington, Victorino Mattis, a self-described very amateur chef. He's assisting managing editor at the Weekly Standard magazine and wrote the cover story, Bam, Making Sense of America's Celebrity Chef Culture. Welcome to you, Vic. Great to have you.
Thanks, Jane. Great to be here.
And from New York, Bill Buford, staff writer at The New Yorker and author of Heat, an amateur's adventures as kitchen slave, line cook, pasta maker, and apprentice to a Dante-quoting butcher in Tuscany. Whew, now out on paperback. Hi, Vic. Bill, welcome to you.
Thank you very much. And I'm very impressed you were able to say that subtitle. I'm
very quickly, too. Vic, let me start with you. I'm told you love to eat. Is that what got you hooked in this world?
Yes, no, absolutely. I've loved, for some people, including friends of mine, you know, it doesn't matter where they go to eat. It's just a normal function of their everyday life, like taking a shower. But for me, since I was a kid, going out to eat was always something very exciting. And it reminds me of, you know, when I was asked earlier about the first sort of fancy eating experience, to the best of my memory, I was about 9 or 10 years old, and it was Windows on the World. Back at the time on top of the World Trade Center.
Sure.
And I remember that very well. And I ordered a James Beard omelet. It was too rich for me. I think there was a prune inside. I really did not like it. But I remember it was the first time I was allowed to sort of order for myself, and that sort of opened up all the possibilities, and I've been hooked ever since.
And how far we've come, right? So what's being sold here, Vic? Food Network, these celebrity chefs. Is this aspirational TV? I want to cook like these people. Is this pure entertainment? What is it?
Well, the easy answer is going to be, it's all entertainment now, and it hasn't been the same since Julia Child. But I think that you have to really break down the shows. If you want to take the Food Network, for example, show by show, different people will argue that certainly some shows are better than others. Anthony Bourdain, who is a terrific chef, told me that, you know, he personally thinks that Ina Garten, for example, the Barefoot Contessa, she's a great chef, and she has a terrific show. It's simple, it's convenient, and it's good for you, whereas he has terrible things to say about somebody like Sandra Lee. I think he told me he puts her up there with Ted Bundy. He said, pure evil. I mean, just terrible. So it depends on what you. Some of them are aspirational, and others are more entertainment. That's true.
What do you think, Bill Buford? Is it about the food? Is it about being a good chef? Or is it about selling yourself, being a showman of sorts?
I'm struck by the remarks about the Barefoot Contessa, which is not produced by the Food Network, although it shows that it's actually a British production. And most of the stuff that's actually produced by the Food Network, with some exceptions, is just television now. It's just it's entertainment. It started as something which had a kind of had something to share and was driven by chefs and was driven by cooking in the way that, say, a good literary magazine might be driven by writing or content. And it's become kind of like a fashion magazine, which is just something, you know, that makes you want to turn the pages, makes you want to sit in front of the television and watch it. It's they look for TV personalities, and most of the shows are TV personality driven.
Vic, it's not just about the chefs and the programs and their cooking. This is an industry that we're talking about. Explain the success of all this from the viewership at some of these programs at the Food Network and really the products that these chefs are selling.
Well, I mean, it's hard to believe now, I think, when somebody says that, you know, the Food Network is available to 90 million homes, right, and it's available in seven continents.
Right.
When they say seven, that means Antarctica, I guess, which I guess somebody's watching it down there. It's hard to believe. And they just opened. But more importantly, the Food Network is now just available in Poland. So I can only imagine what the people of Poland think when they're watching, you know, 30-Minute Meals with Rachel Ray. It must be something so fascinating for them. But it was really very logical at the time when the Food Network was born in the early 90s. It was Reese Schoenfeld, who is the co-creator of CNN.
Yep,
that's right. And he came out and he knew about this sort of cable television fragmentation. You started seeing television channels devoted strictly to music or strictly to, you know, mechanics or this or that, you name it, and or strictly to old movies. And it was only logical that there would have to be a television show out there, a channel strictly devoted to food, and it would be it would transcend what we had seen already on public television.
But because, my goodness, you know, yeah, in 1993, the Food Network was sort of a dump and stir, if you will, right? I mean, the evolution is extraordinary.
That's right. And they really tapped into a market. They were originally available to, I think, only 6.5 million homes. And it's really taken off from there. And they, you know, and with Emeril Lagasse, obviously, that was the real turning point when he was able to get not his first show, which was How to Boil Water, but rather Essence of Emeril and Emeril Live, and sort of his dream of combining elements of a cooking show and Jay Leno, including the band and a live audience. And that really did it for him.
So if Emeril's the pioneer sort of the modern-day celebrity chef, who are the heavy hitters now, Vic? Who's most popular these days?
Well, it's interesting. I think we're still in that early phase of Food Network celebrities. So Emeril Lagasse is still around after 10 or so, more than 10 years. And some of the other guys who, you know, at some point in time, they may have to move on. And I've talked to senior vice presidents at the Food Network, and they're always talking about the constant search for talent. So what we're witnessing here is sort of the middle to near the end, I think, of Emeril Lagasse and that wave of chefs and Rachel Ray. But I think that Rachel Ray is obviously the queen right now, and she presides. If you type in Rachel Ray's name in Google, you get more hits than Emeril Lagasse or Julia Child or anybody else. So she's up there. Giada De Laurentiis, I think that she is going to be even bigger than Rachel, and she's doing the Today Show. She's even, you know, she's doing things now that are no longer related to food. And wait till Nigella Lawson comes on full-time on the Food Network. I think that's in October. And she'll be a big hit, too. What we're seeing now are younger and sexier chefs out there and people like that.
This constant search for talent. Bill Buford, jump in. What do you think of this new crop? Rachel Ray, especially with her magazine, her cookbook. She has her own morning talk show. You know, all her lingo, the yummy-o, the Sammy sandwich, all that stuff.
Well, I don't think they're chefs. And I think Vic misspoke when he said it's a new generation of chefs. They're not chefs. And with Rachel Ray, you know, she began as a shop clerk, pushing gourmet products in a store that where people weren't buying them. And it's a kind of sales rep mentality of wanting to make everybody feel good. And I guess like Tony Bourdain, I loathe Rachel Ray. I loathe Rachel Ray with an intensity that
sometimes
just astonishes me. But I have to pause and say it's not really her fault she's so popular or she's so stupid. People like her and they watch her and they watch her over and over and over again. And really, I suppose what I find so loathsome is that it's a symptom of a kind of shopping mall culture. You watch Rachel Ray, and you're looking at ingredients that have nothing to do with the earth they came from. They're preferably all chopped up. Vic alludes to Tony, you know, quotes Tony where she sort of recommends buying chopped onions from the supermarket. You get chopped melons from the supermarket. Everything comes out of a package. Your meats are sliced up. Nothing. There's no suggestion of an animal or a vegetable or a dirt, and that's all fine. I mean, if that's Rachel Ray's world, that's all fine. But I just look at that and I think this is just loathsome, repellent stuff, and it has nothing to do with chefs. It is a kind of vicarious television porn, which they're very explicit about. I mean, the way they now film food television is very, very different from how it was filmed in the very beginning, and very, very different from how Julia Child was done. It's done. They take their cue from advertising, and they use advertising film techniques, and they use close-ups, and they magnify the sound, and they augment the entire experience to create this kind of vicarious food porn thing.
Vic, do you want to jump in here? Respond?
Yeah, sure. No, I mean, Bill's right. She has said repeatedly, and she says this on television, that I am not a chef. She did not go to, you know, a culinary school. But, you know, I mean, Michael Ruhlman will point out that at the very same, you know, at the same time, you know, she has worked in restaurants and she has worked in the kitchen. And even Anthony Bourdain says, as much as she says she's not a chef, you know, for all intents and purposes, how she portrays herself on television, what she's doing, she's a chef. And I mean, that's how she is. She represents herself as such, even though, I mean, she openly says that she's not. So that's true. There is definitely a disconnect between those type of celebrities and the home cooking. And you're going to see a lot of this now in the future. I think a lot more home cooks are going to have their own shows, that type of thing, Rachel Ray or Giada or Ina Garten or whoever. But and you're going to see a lot less of the professional chefs. I think that's a fear. You know, when I interviewed Michel Richard of Citronelle, and he just won the James Beard Outstanding Chef of the Year Award. He beat Tom Colicchio and other people from across the country. He said, I want to see more French chefs on the Food Network. And he said that if, you know, look at their lineup right now, you will not see a single French chef with his own show. And I think he's right. And I don't think you will see a French chef anytime soon on the Food Network, because they still, you know, when you see a French chef, I think that you still get the impression that it's either somebody who's snooty or somebody who's, you know, way above your league, and you cannot sort of copy that sort of classical French cooking.
But, you know, not just French chefs. It's you know, I mean, he and Tony Bourdain and probably most of us are a kind of romantic rear guard who at one time watched some food television and thought, damn, I could do that, and then went and cooked it. And there was a real kind of pedagogical urgency to what was being done there, and it was refreshing and exciting because, frankly, most of us don't know how to cook. Most of us would like to cook a lot better, and the world is a very expansive and exciting place. But that's not what the television is anymore. They're not going to have any French chefs.
We're talking about America's celebrity chef culture. One of the brightest stars on the Food Network is Alton Brown.
So you finally got yourself a good knife, huh? Well, if Excalibur there is going to take care of you, you're going to have to take care of it, starting with washing. Ooh, you know, that's not a very good idea. Not only can plates and glasses knock your knife around, but harsh dishwashing liquids can damage blades and handles alike, as can that drying cycle. Nope, hand washing is the only real way to go.
We're speaking with Vic Mattis of the Weekly Standard, who wrote the cover story, Bam, Making Sense of America's Celebrity Chef Culture, and with The New Yorker's Bill Buford, author of Heat, an amateur's adventures as kitchen slave, line cook, pasta maker, and apprentice to a Dante-quoting butcher in Tuscany, which is now out in paperback. Joining me now from Atlanta is Alton Brown. He's writer, director, and host of the Peabody Award-winning program Good Eats on the Food Network. You may also know him from Feasting on Asphalt and Iron Chef America. Welcome to you, Alton.
Well, hi, Jane. Thanks for mentioning that Peabody. That's always a nice plug.
Get that in anywhere you can,
yeah,
huh?
I'll just slide that in, yeah.
Yeah. So how'd this all start for you, Alton? How'd you get into this?
I got into this by a strange back door. I was a filmmaker. I had always been in that end of the world and was fascinated with cooking as a hobby. Decided in the early 90s, I was watching food shows and thought, man, this is boring. I'm not learning anything, and I'm falling asleep. I think I want to make a food show. So I quit my job and went off to culinary school to try to get the background that I needed to make a food show, and then kind of just went from there. So I didn't go from chefing to TV. I went from TV to chefing back to TV again.
What do you make of the rise of the success of the Food Network and the celebrity chef culture? What's your take on it in the middle of it?
Well, being that I'm an outsider, I'm not in the club. You know, I don't have a restaurant. I don't even call myself a chef. I think that what we're seeing is the tip of an iceberg that shows that communication is changing, the idea of what we think is entertainment is changing, and most assuredly, different parts of our cultural similarities are showing themselves as being great switchboards for entertainment. I mean, let's face it, food is a universal experience. If we don't eat, we die, and it is a way to pretty much connect every part of the human experience to another. I can't think of many stories that I could tell about anything going on planet Earth without kind of switchboarding it through food. And so I think that although we're dealing with people that are high charisma people. Chefs most certainly are. That helps. But I think we're the bigger picture is that we're seeing a change in what we perceive as kind of viable entertainment, viable education. I'm hoping that Good Eats is kind of, you know, shown a little bit that we can put education and entertainment together to the mutual, you know, benefit of both of those. But as far as the overall phenomenon, I think that it's a natural evolution, not a flare-up.
What's the competition like among these chefs? You say you're an outsider, but you're certainly in the middle of it. There are a lot of egos involved, I know. You know, I've got three shows, I've got five, I've got a line of pots and pans, I've got a magazine. What do you got?
We don't have like a secret clubhouse where we all get together. It's not like the Justice League or anything. You know, we don't all fly in by private helicopter and sit down and decide the fate of the food world. I mean, I run into members of this community just a few times a year. Certainly my involvement on the program Iron Chef America has put me in contact with far more chefs than I've ever, you know, been with before. And although I think that there's certainly a competitive nature, you don't exist in a kitchen, you don't exist in television without having a competitive spirit. But I'll be honest, I've never seen anything but good manners amongst all of them. When I first started at Food Network, in fact, I was a nobody. And I remember, you know, the first time I met Mario Batali, came up and put some spit on his thumb and rubbed something that I had off of my face and kind of kept going. There was no sense of, you know, no hazing rituals, no resentment. So I've never seen anything except kind of everybody's just, you know, doing what they do.
So what's your goal then, Alton? What are you trying to accomplish?
I'm trying to maintain employment mostly.
Make money?
My attitude is, you know, I own a small factory down here in Atlanta, and I make a product. I make two products. Well, I provide a service, which is that I lease myself out for things, and then I make a product, which is Good Eats and Feasting on Asphalt. And all I can hope is that there's a market for product. That's all I am. I don't see it as anything else. You know, it's a market-driven thing. I either make something somebody wants or I don't.
This market-driven thing, then, I mean, what do you make of your success? You've got best-selling books, all these personal appearances, all these shows you're working on. What do you make of this?
I find it really strange because I don't, I'm still very kind of outside myself in that regard. I don't see that as me. I feel like I'm pulling off a really great con job, and eventually I'm going to be caught, sentenced to obscurity. Or, like we've actually been joking, that when the final Good Eats episode does come, the whole thing, it'll be a takeoff on Newhart, and I will simply kind of snap awake, and I'll be working the fry station at some fast food place, and I've dreamed the whole thing.
At least you're honest.
We'll be, you know, the way that goes.
Hey, Alton, someone's got a call for you in Boston. George is on the line. Hi, George, go ahead with Alton Brown.
Hi, Jane. Thanks.
Hi.
I wanted to say that I ran across the show accidentally flipping through channels once, and it just kind of blew me away. I thought the fact that there was no table between the host and the viewer, there was actually, you know, literally no stage. You know, there are no catchphrases, and the camera angles are what sort of caught my eye. I thought, and after watching just a couple minutes, I realized, you know, this guy has totally reinvented the cooking show. It possibly saved it.
And thanks for calling, Dad. you know, all I can say about that is that we everybody that works on Good Eats came from the television world, and most of us came from commercials. I spent about 10 years directing commercials, which are, you know, an extremely visual art form that, you know, only survives by being very visual. So what we hoped to do was to, I figured if I was going to make a food show, number one, it was going to have to compete visually with things like commercials and music videos. And the other thing is that I really believe that we have a saying here, laughing brains are more absorbent. So we feel that comedy kind of softens up the target so that you can slip in the viral information.
Well, how much of then is it about the food, and how much is it, Alton, about putting on a show?
First and foremost, this is an entertainment medium. I truly believe that my job, above all, is to get you to watch half an hour of television and enjoy it. The greatest compliment that I can get is when a family of five will come up to me and say, hey, you know, Good Eats is really the only thing on TV that we'll all sit down and watch together. Mm-hmm. No one's insulted. No one's offended. That's number one. You know, number two, if some restaurant cooks come up to me and say, man, we love your show, it really helps us do our job, that's the second best. So I would have to say that first and foremost, is hopefully provide good, intelligent entertainment. And I would say that that's across the line. I don't think anybody at Food Network would even argue and say, oh, it's just about the food. Food's the medium, certainly. And I think that all of us are dedicated to that and giving good information about that. But this is an entertainment medium.
So then with that said, who paved the way for you? Who are your heroes? Who are your mentors?
Well, one time someone once said that Good Eats, in the early days, they said Good Eats was a dinner party between Julia Child, Monty Python, and Mr. Wizard. And I would say that that's a great encapsulation of that. And I would put all three of those pretty high on my list. But I'll be honest with you, Good Eats was formatted on Pee-wee's Playhouse.
Interesting. You mentioned Julia Child. What do you think she'd think of this phenomenon of the celebrity chef?
I never got to ask her. I never personally met the woman. I think I would have been too scared probably to meet her. I don't think she would have been surprised a bit by it. I think that she would say, well, of course, this is fascinating stuff. This is interesting. This is fun. Talking about it is fun. You know, people gravitate to the kitchen wherever they are. It makes perfect sense that as the television replaces the hearth of the American home, that we would want a kitchen to be there, which is what Food Network has provided. We're the kitchen of that particular house. So I don't think she'd be surprised at all. As a matter of fact, I think she would be the last person to be surprised by it.
Bill Buford, let me bring you back in. I want to respond to what Alton Brown has said. His show is fun. It's part showbiz, and it's viable entertainment for the whole family. What's your take?
I agree completely, but I think he's also being too modest. And I think the essential drive of his programs, which I love, is his curiosity. And even in telling his little autobiography, I mean, at the heart of it was that one of the bits he left out is that he went, you know, wanting to do food television, he then went to cooking school and moved with his wife up to New England, and she took a secretarial job so he could learn how to be a completely accomplished cook before he went back and started doing the television. And the television is really driven by great curiosity of, like, why are avocados like the way they are? What is coffee? What is corn? What is beef? And what are these different cuts of meat? And it's that kind of curiosity that I think a lot of us find so appealing, because the world of food is as big as the world itself. And there's a real kind of drive in these shows to learn something. And what I find in them is that the person who really wants to learn it is the man presenting it. And that's infectious. Mm-hmm. And that's extremely appealing.
I'm glad you say that, because I've had teachers ask me, you know, what is the basis of your education, you know, being able to educate people. And I always say curiosity first. If the teacher can be curious, can have a desire to know, that is extremely infectious. And
essential. It's absolutely essential.
The Good Eats episodes that I like the most were the ones that were made during a time when I was learning the most, you know, when I was actually right on the cusp of really getting something about whatever that subject was. And I think that it's when, and chefs are bad about this, when they start thinking they know everything and they're not curious anymore, they become unbelievably dull.
And their restaurants usually die.
And the restaurants usually die because then the adventure is over, the discovery is over. And the best chefs are always looking for more, looking to discover in themselves, looking to discover in the world. And I think anyone that is a true chef will say that their desire to cook is a reflection on their just kind of wanting to devour the planet from a discovery standpoint, not just from like a gluttony standpoint, but from that desire to want to know and to discover.
Vic Mattis, jump in here. What's your take on all this?
Well, first of all, let me just say I'm a big fan of the other two guests that you have on the show right now. I'm currently reading Bill's book, Heat. And it set a terrible precedent, I think, for food writers, because I'm more of the school of A.J. Liebling in between meals, where I like to get my experience from eating food. But I think now everybody that wants to write about food is going to have to work in the kitchen.
Yep.
And I myself, I'm working on a book, of course, on this whole celebrity chef culture. And I have a friend who says, you know, you got to get on that line. We're going to make you do dish. And you know, and it's going to be a real humiliating experience. And I know that. I mean, if it was a difficult time for Buford, you know, working at Babot, it's not going to be an easy time for me. I mean, you know, they talk about, you know, they're on their feet all the time. They're, you know, 18 hours a day. I was, you know, cutting string beans the other day. After 10 minutes, my back was hurting. So I'm in for a real shock. And as for Alton Brown, I mean, again, his shows, I agree, are great. I just impressed somebody the other day at my office by pointing out when we were in the kitchen, I said, oh, you have a Dr. Pepper. I said, you know, that was first introduced in the 1904 World's Fair in St. Louis. And I got that from Alton's show. But no, those are, you know, I mean, it is what we're seeing now is a real phenomenon. And I mean, but again, there are differences between different chefs. I mean, you have great chefs, and then you have those who, as Bill mentioned, are not so great.
Alton Brown, I appreciate your time with us from Atlanta. Thanks for squeezing us into your day. Writer, director, and host of Peabody Award-winning program Good Eats on the Food Network.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
I'm going to get back on the set and make some more.
All right. Take care.
Thank you so much.
I want to go to the phones now, and Monica, who's calling from Aiken, South Carolina. Hi, Monica. Go ahead.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I have so many comments on this. I don't know where to start.
Okay.
But I'm a former food magazine staffer, so obviously I've spent a lot of time thinking about this. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I thought of is that, you know, I personally, my own personal cooking ethos is very much looking for authentic foods and not, you know, shortcut things like Rachael Ray. But I also think that, you know, Rachael Ray, that whole phenomenon is very much, you know, part of our larger American culture, which is we commodify everything we love. We have, you know, I think Wolfgang Puck was really one of the first celebrity chefs, and, you know, fittingly, he was, you know, cooking in L.A. And but I also have a problem with, you know, even though I consider myself kind of a food snob, and certainly, you know, some of my good friends and colleagues who are wonderful cooks love to loathe Rachael Ray, and, you know, I did too. And then one day, you know, I was watching her show at home because I couldn't watch the Food Network for a long time until I left my magazine job because it was just too much.
You were watching her and you thought what?
But, you know, I thought, you know, she had like a recipe for a meatloaf and it didn't look bad and you can make it in 30 minutes. And you know what? I got some tips from her and I made it and it was great. So, I mean, I sometimes think that we overthink this. You know, she is making it, you know, some of us might not like her approach. We might prefer the Jacques Pepin approach on PBS, which, you know, I loved watching that, and it was instructional and it was inspirational.
But Rachael Ray is a real person, and she's doing it in real time. Vic Mattis, Bill Buford, what's wrong with sort of being an inspirational chef, giving people with real lives real options for cooking?
We're going to come away from this. We're going to learn how to love Rachel. That's the motto. I felt like such a curmudgeon saying how I loathe Rachael Ray. I promise I love Rachael. You know, it's a perfectly valid point, but I'm so happy that caller has fallen in love with Rachael, and I'm going to work on it. I'm going to watch it tonight at 6 and 6:30, and again at 10 and 10:30, and again tomorrow at 2 in the morning and 2:30. You know, that one of the things about the kitchen is that it is the great narrative. It has always been the great narrative. You start with raw ingredients, and end up with the finished thing. And as Alton Brown was saying, that, you know, the television has replaced the hearth, it's quite natural that we would find a kitchen there, and we're all the very natural audience for watching people make food. And Rachael Ray does that just like everybody else does. There's a very essential kind of storytelling thing in all of it. And maybe I'll learn.
There's no doubt that Rachael Ray is a very smart, brilliant person too. I mean, she may not have gone to culinary school, but she certainly knew what the public was after. Again, and Bill mentioned this earlier, how she started in New York State and she was buying food for a gourmet store and wondering, you know, why aren't people, you know, buying some of these ingredients? And they said because it's too expensive and they don't have time. And then she started holding these cooking classes. They were sold out. She decided to write a book on 30-minute meals. I think it sold 10,000 copies locally. And the next thing you know, Al Roker buys her book. She's on the Today Show. Mm-hmm. And then she walks away from the Food Network with two shows. Now I think she has 4+1 not on the Food Network.
And an empire unto herself. We're talking about America's celebrity chef culture and all the trimmings. One of the most popular shows on television is the Fox Network's Hell's Kitchen. Chef Gordon Ramsay lets it rip.
Just explain to me what it is, please.
It's an undone focaccia bread with a garlic dipping oil.
Undone? What does that mean, undone?
It means it's not done.
Oh, so half-baked focaccia bread. Oh, my God.
We're speaking with Bill Buford, author of Heat, now out in paperback, and with Vic Mattis of the Weekly Standard, who just wrote the cover story, Bam, Making Sense of America's Celebrity Chef Culture. I'd like to bring in another voice now from Hyde Park, New York, is Eve Felder. She's Associate Dean for Culinary Arts at the Culinary Institute of America. Hi, Eve. Nice to have you.
Hi, Jane.
So you're looking at a new class up there, the freshman class at the Culinary Institute.
We are.
Anything in particular strike you about this new crop of wannabe chefs?
You know, we enter students every 3 weeks, so we constantly are seeing new faces. But this time of year is when we get our fresh young faces who have just come out of high school, and they are embracing this industry. And
why? Why are they?
You know, I think for a lot of reasons. I think probably the one of the biggest reasons is that food's everywhere you look. They're immersed in food, and I think the Food Network has done an enormous amount to help in the entertainment arena, and kids are watching the Food Network.
So they're embracing it because they love food and they want to be a great chef, or they want to be a star on TV?
All of the above.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? You can't separate them. It's where we are now. We can't, our job at the Culinary Institute of America is that we train them in the fundamentals of being great chefs.
Hmm.
So that when they graduate, they have a foundation that is strong, but they look at the TV network, I mean at the Food Network, and that's for some of them a real big goal. I was at orientation on August 21st and was talking to the asking, you know, where do you see yourself? Who are you going to be? And how many of you think you will be on the Food Network? And about 40% of them raised their hand.
Hmm.
It is something that they look at and see as a potential. Now, our job as the Culinary Institute of America is that we train them, in the techniques of cookery, but that we also have co-curricular activities so that they are able to see what's out there for themselves.
Like
we will do.
Like what?
We'll have a workshop on digital media. How do you do a food blog? And bring in the big food bloggers, so that they can get a hand not only get the talk about how I did it, but also how do you actually get yourself set up?
And I presume that's something you didn't do just a few years ago.
No.
So you're really changing and evolving to sort of match the food industry.
We have to.
Mm-hmm.
We have to stay current.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, on new techniques, how do you do foams? How do you do gels? How do you promote yourself? How do you package yourself? But you can't package something that you aren't. You've got to be real.
Got to have the basics at first. Let me ask you, Eve, who are these students? You mentioned these young kids that are just out of high school, but do you have older folks?
Do you have?
Yeah?
Uh-huh. We do.
What are the demographics?
Our average age is 25, and so we get this time of year, because we enter every 3 weeks, we enter 96 students every 3 weeks. And so this time of year, we get high school students, but when it's January and in the spring, we end up bringing in career changers, and we have a huge percentage of career changers.
Mm-hmm.
People who have said, you know what, I've worked as an engineer, or I've worked as a physician, or I've worked as a nuclear scientist for the last 20 years, and I want to find my dream.
Mm.
I want to follow my dream, and they're fabulous students. Because their passion is, they've done it, and they're totally ready to take this on.
Hmm. What do you think, sort of personally, of this new world of the celebrity chef? Do you think you lose something along the way with all this showmanship and productizing and having to teach, you know, not just food preparation but blogging in culinary school?
You know, I think I actually see it as good. It's like technology. It's like the computer. It's like the cell phone. If you don't embrace it, you're going to be left behind. And our job at the CIA is that we're aware of these things, and not that we change our core curriculum, but that we have co-curricular activities that will meet the students of this era.
Mm-hmm. Let me bring Bill Buford and Vic Mattis back in. What do you both think about what Eve's saying? So many students coming in, raising their hands, saying, I want to be a star. I want to be on the Food Network. Bill?
It's, you know, I agree with Eve. It's just, it's the culture now. And There are lots of different ways of interpreting it. One might simply be that chefs have become our celebrities, and celebrities generate their own kind of energy and sort of perpetuate themselves on their own celebrity status. But there is a an interest in the mysterious transformative process of cooking. And that's not the first time it's happened in the history of civilization by any means, and it's a very exciting moment. And it's, you know, another way to look at it is that we should be proud to be in this moment and proud to be here talking for an hour about food and television and cooking food on television. And it's a special moment in the culture.
Let's go to the phones. Lake Placid, New York is where Moses is. Hi, Moses. You're on the line.
Hi. Good morning. How are you, Jane?
Hi. Good. How are you?
Good. Thanks. I would first like to kind of address that introduction about Gordon Ramsay that was just done.
Yeah.
I've been a chef for 48 years, own my own restaurant.
Yeah.
My formal education is anthropology and sociology.
Uh-huh.
And he's a disgrace to the industry, to treat people like he does on television. It's just terrible.
What do you think more broadly of the Food Network and of the celebrity chef culture?
Oh, the Food Network, it's fabulous. We had the good fortune of having Rachel Ray in our restaurant, and I cannot tell you what it's done for us in the way of increasing business. You know, she's a lovely young lady. She's not pretentious or precocious. She knows exactly where her limitations are in food. And, you know, it's very, very refreshing. She makes it fun. It's entertaining.
Moses, thanks so
much. To her and Lagasse and the rest of the guys, they've raised the bar for the average public. I mean, they learn more. They know more about food. They know more about techniques.
Thanks so much, Moses. I appreciate your time and your call. Let's go to Cambridge, Massachusetts. Isabel is on the line. Hi, Isabel. Go ahead.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
Hi, good.
I'm calling to comment on how I absolutely love food. I love to cook. It's a passion of mine. And another passion is really empowering youth of color to feel that they can do whatever they want to do. And I've recognized, watching the Food Network, watching Hell's Kitchen, all these various food shows, that there are not a lot of chefs of color on TV or that make it up to that next level. And I was wondering if your guests could talk about that and touch upon why that might be.
Good question, Isabel. Thank you. I'll turn to Vic Mattis and let you answer that, Vic.
Sure. I mean, there are a number of celebrity chefs who talk about how this is a real problem. Daniel Ballou talks about it, and I believe he talks about it in his great mentoring book called Letters to a Young Chef, and he thinks that there needs to be more. It is interesting, though, that the caller mentions some of the shows like Hell's Kitchen. This year's winner of Hell's Kitchen is an African-American chef who was a chef actually from the Washington, D.C. area. He was a chef at Union Station at a restaurant called B. Smith's, and he won this competition, and the grand prize is running your own restaurant, or at least being a senior chef at a restaurant, and that's where he is going to be in Las Vegas. But it is a concern. I mean, I talk to other chefs about it, and they talk about how they can't really put their finger on it. Jacques Pepin said the same thing. They'd like to see more, but it's not really quite happening yet. But again, you are seeing some of this on television. Hell's Kitchen is that one example.
I'm Mary now from Northampton, Massachusetts. Hi, Mary. Go ahead.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Thank you so much. I really am enjoying this topic. I love the Food Network. I love Top Chef on Bravo. When my partner and I were gone recently on vacation, we filled up an 8-hour videotape just of food shows because now that's all we watch anymore with a 7-month-old. You have 1 hour of TV, and it's that. But much as I love it, I think that the Food Network and Top Chef and these kind of shows really foster sort of a passive enjoyment of food as opposed to something that's really active and getting you engaged. And I watch these shows and I want to cook the stuff that they're making, but I never go and look up the recipes and I never actually make this food. And
Mary,
excuse me, now that we're only watching the Food Network, we're actually going to cancel cable and start trying to sort of teach our son how to cook just by looking at cookbooks and cooking ourselves instead of watching TV.
Interesting. Mary, thanks so much for your call. Bill Buford, what do you think about this, this sort of passive enjoyment of watching but not really doing?
Well, we have two 23-month-old toddler twins, and one of them, my Frederick, is obsessed with cooking and imitates it all day long because I am at least in the kitchen quite a bit. And there's something to it. There's no question there's something it's our vicarious experience of the kitchen, probably enjoyed by a culture that has never been more ignorant about cooking, possibly in the history of civilization. Supermarkets and fast foods, and supermarkets themselves have really become an outlet of a fast food, have done this to us. And, I mean, the positive thing is that at least there is the curiosity and the interest, and people want to know. And here's someone who's prepared to turn the television show off for an hour and do some cooking.
Back to the phones now with Chris, who's calling from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Hi, Chris. You're on the line.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I just wanted to comment on, you know, how the books have come along quite a ways, where when Anthony Bourdain first wrote Kitchen Confidential, it was more geared towards the actual restaurant cook. And now we have books like Heat, you know, that are more geared towards the general public. You know, I worked for some people, and they've read Heat, and they were amazed at how many pages were dedicated just to the amount of containers that restaurants use. And I think that also that chefing, you know, was not such a noble profession maybe 10 or so years ago, but now I feel like, you know, it's been more brought into the spotlight with the Food Network. And that's why we see so many people wanting to do these career changes, and the attendance at the CIA growing so largely. And, you know, I just wanted to comment on that.
Chris, thank you. Thank you so much. You know, Chris brings up the notion of books and chefs writing books. And I actually was interested to read in your article, Vic, how Julia Child sort of shunned all this extracurricular activity, if you will, as far as products and endorsing things. She did obviously write books, but she didn't want to get into that at all. It was very pure for her, wasn't it?
That's true. I mean, she had some sort of, I think there was some limited experience with product placement, but by and large, she looked down on it, and she didn't really approve of, I think, James Beard, for example, and some of the stuff, the product ties that he did. But of course, Beard explained that, you know, he needed the money, and that's perfectly understandable. In Julia Child's case, I think what is also interesting is how long it took her to write that first book. It's something, I think, 10 years at least. And her book advance, I believe, was $750, and she had to pay for her own publicity tour in the United States. It was a real labor of love.
The book was turned down. The first publisher turned it down. It was just too
much. That's right. It was
Houghton
Mifflin.
People weren't going to be interested in it. That's right. Knopf was the second publisher, was the runner-up, when no one else would take it. It was sort of a great, massive work of kind of determination and intelligence. It's like sort of the first bit of reporting of French cooking for an American audience. It's a great tome.
Michael is on the line now from Boston. Hi, Michael. You're on the line. Go ahead.
Yes. Good hello.
Hello.
I'm struck by the dissonance between the food on the programs, which often looks very good, and the real crap being advertised in the commercials in between. And it makes the whole thing seem like something of a bait and switch or cheat.
Interesting, Michael. Thank you. Any comments, Vic, Bill?
Well, I mean, it's true. I mean, the food that you see on the actual show is delicious. But, you know, you have these commercials and, you know, there are certain products. The focus is strictly on time. You know, we know that you're working parents and you have kids to feed and you have maybe 30 minutes or less to feed them. And here's a great way to just, you know, dump and stir or something in a package. I mean, be on the lookout for this new, I think what they call sous vide. And it's this sort of cryogenic vacuum packed food. Even Daniel Boulud and Charlie Trotter are getting in on the action, and it's supposed to be convenient, and at the same time, it's supposed to be tasty. I don't know. I have not tried it yet myself.
It actually is fabulous because this is
Eve Felder, yeah.
Because you cook the product all within its own juices, so you can sear a lamb chop, get that incredible searness, then put it into Cryovac, slowly cook it so it's not overcooked and it's cooking in its own juices, and then all you have to do is take it out of the bag, hit it again in a saute pan to sear it again, and it's ready for service. It's a fabulous, fabulous technique that a lot of restaurants are using.
A lot of restaurants. It's a way of controlling the heat. It's really a great approach to controlling heat.
It is. There are health codes that are connected to it that we actually are teaching about how do you get a HACCP plan.
Ah. Interesting. Eve Felder, I'm going to let you go. Associate Dean for Culinary Arts at the Culinary Institute of America. I know you have a busy day. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
From Hyde Park, New York. Thank you. We're going to wrap up here in the last minute and a half. Bill Buford and Vic Manis, final thoughts. You know, where do you sort of see this going in the years to come? We've come such a long way, such a short time. Vic?
Well, the interesting thing is, I really do think, I mean, this is, it's only the beginning. I mean, there are certain questions about what is going to be a fad and what is not. Our reality series competitions, is that just a fad? Is that a passing moment? It certainly lingered longer than anybody thought it would. But the interesting thing, for me at least, is that where it's coming from, this fascination with food and the celebrity chef culture, it is coming from countries like the United States and England, which, you know, for a long time, two countries that were not exactly known for their best food. There's not as much, from what I understand, some of the reporting I did, as much of a celebrity chef culture, say, in France or in Italy. Mm-hmm. But it's happening now in England and the United States, and it's interesting to observe that sort of renaissance.
Last 20 seconds to you, Bill Buford.
And I think out of that renaissance, there's people are once again discovering local food, and that's probably going to be the future. It's going to be green markets and realizing that foods don't have to come from supermarkets, and you can take them home and make them and have one of the greatest pleasures on earth, which is eating.
Mm. Bill Buford, staff writer for The New Yorker, author of Heat, joining us from New York. Bill, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Vic Mattis, assistant managing editor at the Weekly Standard Magazine. He wrote the cover story, Bam, Making Sense of America's Celebrity Chef Culture. Thanks so much for your time, Vic.
Thanks, Jane.
I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.